It's a throwback to 2022. It's not about how Red Bull won, it's kind of how Mercedes lost. Weird. Welcome back to Motorsport 101.
It's been a long time since we've been able to say that.
It's been a long time since we've been able to say, hey, what's that rain coming down for? Well, hey guys, welcome to episode 523 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. Glad you could join us for another edition of the show. Hope you guys are having a good one, a good Le Mans week, shall we say, because we got a big one with the 92nd running of the 24 Hours of Le Mans coming up this weekend, and we will have a full preview of that in our next episode right before the off as well. But in the meantime, here is our Canadian Grand Prix review. A genuinely great race. Like, I think comfortably the best F1 race of 2024 by a country mile compared to Monaco. Oh, man. This was a thousand times better.
Desperately needed to wash the taste out of that new fresh hell of a zero-stop Monaco out of our mouths.
Just you saying zero stop Monaco is just like nightmare fuel for me.
It's like all the birds have stopped singing. It's dark outside. There's a chill in the air. Thankfully, we don't have to talk about that race ever.
Yeah,
maybe for the Golden Cock end of the year.
Maybe. We have to wait and see how the nominations go down for that one. But yes, that's Cam Buckley. It's just Cam for the next two episodes because RJ is actually at Le Mans this weekend doing actual journalism work for Daily Sports Car.
Yeah, look at him having an actual journalism job. So incredibly proud of you, RJ. Enjoy every minute of it. I know I will from afar, regardless of how terrible or great things go for my picked chosen cars.
Yeah, it's becoming one of those real rounds where all of our friends end up over there in some capacity. Shout out to Danny Brennan and his partner Anna. I know a friend of the show, Elizabeth Blackstock's down there. I know Taylor from our Discord server's down there as well, and of course RJ representing as ever, doing a fantastic job for DSC. He's chipped in a lot with our season preview as well, despite working a full schedule over this week. So huge thanks to RJ O'Connor for that. We'll mention that again in our preview for that as well. But we've actually got a lot to talk about in this F1 episode this time round. I mean, a genuinely thrilling fight for the win between three different manufacturers, but maybe one of which you maybe didn't expect going into the weekend. That's for damn sure. We'll talk a little bit about that and how Mercedes came to play this weekend with maybe their most competitive weekend in maybe 18 months. Wild. What happened to the prancing Haunts? Because just when you thought the Haunts was dead.
Is back. The Haunts parading through the streets, confetti pouring down, playing like Rufus Shinra's theme from Final Fantasy VII as they just screwed everything up.
Just when you thought the Haunts was dead, the coffin came up and the Undertaker sat up. The Haunts is alive and well. We'll talk about that. And there'll be a bit of a silly season update as well, because there's been a lot of contract news that's come through in the last few weeks, mostly because we also didn't talk about Monaco. Sergio Perez on a new contract, Yuki Tsunoda on a new contract, and Esteban Ocon not on a new contract, as it's announced he's leaving Alpine at the end of the season. So all of that, and an update on the brand new 2026 car regulations that came out this past week as well. A lot to break down with that. So all of that in the next hour or so. We haven't even got time to talk about Cam's smug Boston Celtics. What a shame. But well, we can get a little bit in here, I suppose.
Shame.
Fuck off. but places you can find us real quick. We're on youtube.com/motorsport101. Subscribe if you want to listen to your podcasts on there. You can do so if you like. Just automatically subscribe to our RSS feed. Then you can get YouTube videos of all of our podcasts as well. Shame they're not the old ways where we're all live, but we're not quite a visual medium, even though we kind of are now. It's kind of weird. You can also check out motorsport101.com if you want written reviews as bonus content on this past race in Canada, and IndyCar's Grand Prix of Road America. Now, we are doing a podcast for that episode, but it's going to be next week to make room for Le Mans. The unfortunate nature of our schedules mean we often record these on Wednesdays, so having three podcasts so close in the back end of the week doesn't really make sense. We've got a free week for IndyCar. We thought we might as well use it. So if you're looking for a Road America podcast, listen in next week. We'll try and get that in when we can, alongside a full review of the 24 Hours of Le Mans next week as well. You can follow us on social media, on Elon Musk's failed business investment, now with hidden likes, apparently, at motorsport_101. Our personal handles are at DreHarrison101, at CBuckley917, and at RJ O'Connell if you want to follow RJ when he is on the show. As always, you can follow us on Instagram at motorsport101pod for our Instagram page, forgive me. And our Patreon page, if you'd like to back us financially, you can. patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. I've also started including sneak peeks at DRR pieces a little bit early as well, and I tend to do them for all Patreon levels. So even if you back us for $1, you'll get some free writing for free earlier as well now, just to sweeten the deal a little bit more for you Patreon backers out there as well. So big thanks as well, because I know we've got a new Patreon backer as well that joined just for that, for a Canapino post that came out a little bit early. I'm going to try and find it. Yes, Jane Bleach. Thank you very much, Jane, for backing us on Patreon. Much appreciated. Thank you so much for that. So even more bang for your buck if you back us on our Patreon page. If you back us at the $10 level, you get access to the supporters club of our Discord server, where you can listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded, like Jason is doing right now. Thanks much for listening, mate. Hope you enjoy the shows as ever. Without further ado, let's get into the Canadian Grand Prix.
As it so often is in Montreal, it was a race of changeable conditions, as a late shower just before the start of the race led to the rare wet standing start.
Mm.
George Russell had held on to his early lead from a tied dead heat pole position.
Yeah.
Max Verstappen.
The first time in 27 years that we had a dead heat for pole position. It's only ever happened once in Formula One history before that, and that was the famous Jerez 1997 Spanish Grand Prix, with the infamous three-way tie between Michael Schumacher, Damon Hill, and Heinz-Harald Frentzen. So this is the 1,110th Grand Prix weekend, only the second ever tied pole position. Pretty cool.
What was neat as well, it also came on a complete 112 dead. 0-0-0. What are the chances of that ever happening again?
Yeah, fun fact. That was also only the second ever pole position where the time was exact to three decimal places.
Fantastic.
It's only ever happened once before. Yeah, I asked. Shout out to Sundaram from the F1 Stats Guru, who sent me that one, by the way. Much appreciated, Sundaram. Does great work for the race and a bunch of other places as well, the Inside Line podcast. So shout out to Sundaram. Wanted to give him a mention.
Yeah, those two chased each other into the distance right up until the point where they blew their intermediate tires off. Lando Norris caught, passed, and drove away from both of them with blistering pace until a Logan Sargeant safety car forced the field back together again, with Norris falling to the same thing that helped him win in Miami, falling back to third. From there, it was Max Verstappen the rest of the way, navigating another stop and gamble from McLaren that backfired, leaving Max in front to eventually claim win number 60 for the Flying Dutchman. Dre, this was as topsy-turvy as a race as we've had in a while.
It really was, wasn't it? I mean, this was a race where any four or five different people could have won it at any given point if luck, if strategy played a certain way. We genuinely didn't know who was going to win this race until about 10 laps out. Really, like this was the sort of race where you could have gone anywhere with it. George did a very solid job leading from the front of the field. If anything, the best way I can sum this race up was that it was a fascinating race seeing three different teams working out how to handle intermediate tires on a drying track and how that played into the race. Red Bull had strong, consistent pace, but burned their inters too much with Max looking to try and find a way around George Russell early on, but couldn't because...
There was points where George was, he was practically pushing George through sector two for the whole second half of that first stint.
But you couldn't go offline because there was such a difference between the dry line on track and then going offline with so much water and standing water still there. You'd be taking far too much of a risk if you tried to pass anybody on it. So you couldn't overtake in those sorts of conditions without taking a huge gamble. It wasn't until 15, 16 laps in when we saw what happened when Lando Norris saved his intermediate tire and then was able to push. All of a sudden, he's 3 seconds faster than the field. It was incredible to watch.
Yeah, I mean, really both McLarens, it seems like they were able to protect their wets really well. And both of them were running down the front two who just, they chased each other's tires off. And all of that would have worked out great for McLaren were it not for the aforementioned safety car for Logan Sargeant, who just is on a fast track to nowhere right now. Fast track out of F1. It's every now and again you see a little glimpse and Logan puts together a lap where he's up around Albon's pace. And then he proves all the haters, the doubters, the naysayers absolutely correct.
He was 0.06 off making Q3 for just the second time in his career. First time since Zandvoort last year if he would have made it, and he would have knocked out his teammate if he'd gotten there. He was on a quicker lap, but it was held up in traffic. Sargeant claims he was held up in traffic. I can't say for sure, but it was still one of his better qualifying performances of his F1 career. And then he goes and spins out at turn six, but pulled out a safety car. Lando Norris had a 10-second lead, but the safety car was deployed when Norris was just 100, 200
approaching
meters.
Approaching the Wall of Champions.
Yeah, he was 200 meters out from the braking zone for the final chicane when the safety car deployed, so McLaren couldn't call him in time. I don't know if you remember, like, China 2019, when that was that famous race where Sebastian Vettel was leading, and then as he's going past China's main straight, they called a
18.
Safety car.
It was Valtteri leading, and the Red Bulls got the rub of the green there.
That's what happened here. Norris
basically the same thing.
Yeah, Norris had to sit behind the safety car. The safety car picked up the leader. He lost all of that 10-second advantage running behind the safety car while everybody else could follow the Delta. And Verstappen circled his way back to the front, with Norris sinking back to third. And from there, really, Max was in control of the race, and he was the one that kept the coolest head under pressure. I mean, we saw the track finally dry enough for slicks around lap 45, and that's when we saw, the key moment of the race. That was Pierre Gasly, who was first to switch onto the slicks. It was a little bit too early, but they were in the ballpark for it. Hamilton was next to react to the leaders. Max came in to Max and Piastri and Russell came in to cover Hamilton off. Norris kept going for two more laps. His pace on the inters was genuinely good. No one was arguing that, but it was Lando's call as to whether to change for slicks or not. He kept going for one lap too many, and he lost the advantage while the dry runners were getting through their heat-up phase for the tyres, and you saw the key moment. Norris come out of the pits, desperately trying to get back on the racing line, squirms as Verstappen blows pie, and then after that, Max, it was never really in doubt after that one, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, the weird thing is, it worked. Norris got out of the pits ahead, but offline, especially in the first sector, was just impossible. to get power down out of. And I do applaud McLaren for putting it in his hands and having him go to work, because, I mean, another sector's worth of tire warm-up for Verstappen, Norris might have got out ahead. I do think McLaren's pace in the dry was a little bit more shaky than their pace in the really mixed stuff. What was the bigger shock this weekend was Mercedes. I mean, their most competitive weekend since Brazil 22, and it really ain't close. If this race is defined by that fight between Norris and Verstappen, it's as much defined by just the number of mistakes that Russell made in the race, as he was debatably the fastest of the set, but he kept giving himself too much work to do, whether it was trying to pass Oscar Piastri late on, sending himself down out the inside and almost wiping them both out into the wall of champions, had to bail out of it. He had a mistake through the middle sector, basically did a miniature version of what Seb did in 2019, running wide, drop behind Norris again. He kept giving himself too much work to do.
Yeah, Norris and Russell were both pretty clumsy in that fight, where Norris were trying to heat his tires up, locked up at the Adelaide hairpin, and let Russell through. And then when Russell was back in second again, he made a mistake at turn 9 on that chicane. He took too much curb and almost lost control of his car. It was very similar to the crash he had here last year.
The holy moly, as we call it now.
And that's what opened the door for Norris to get back into second place again. I don't want to keep ragging this narrative drum about George Russell making mistakes under pressure, but this is another race where you feel like he may have left some extra points on the table, some extra performance on the table, if he hadn't made a couple of avoidable errors. It's like a game of tennis. You can't keep giving your opponent unforced errors. They will punish you eventually. And that's what happened here.
And what have we said? Even last year, you know, times where the Red Bull is not mighty, and here it was competitive, but certainly not the dominant force. Just it has a very tough time with roll stiffness, this Red Bull, where, excuse me, if it's a kind of a flat, smooth track where they can use their aero, they're gone. But if they have to really eat curbs to make lap time, they're not as strong.
None.
In this instance, if this is where McLaren and Mercedes are, because Mercedes brought a complete re-architecting of their front wing, and it seems to have helped their car a lot. Their drivers they have to step up to the occasion, because sorry to those on Twitter who would claim sabotage, but it's in the data. Lewis made a little mistake on his final lap in Q3. Through the final chicane, cost him a couple tenths, is what it is. But that kind of defined his race from there. George, bunch of mistakes in the race. Norris, a couple little mistakes. Max made one big one early on, going off through turn 1 and 2. But in the second half of this race, he was just a metronome in the mixed conditions going into dry, and that is where the fuck it, we've got Max Verstappen meme is kind of legit. When he can just go out and punish you lap after lap, and you have to overexert yourself to try and keep up with it. Along with the fact that Red Bull judged pretty much every call this race, that operational excellence, pretty much right on the money. It's just too good a combination.
I saw the lap times on that final 12-lap restart we had. Max set that critical first lap on the restart where he got 1.5 seconds in hand on Norris. And that point in the race was over. I looked at the times. Verstappen was consistently 3 or 4 tenths quicker than Lando Norris pretty much the rest of the way through in that race. And as we said, Red Bull got every call on the money. And then Max did what he needed to do at the front of the race. Once his mediums got going, no one could touch him.
Dude, that final restart, that was like prime Sebastian Vettel-esque, where Seb would wind up on cold tires and just break out the paddle on everybody. I mean, by the end of that first lap, he was well over a second clear. hold the safe gap. Little scare against the Wall of Champions with a couple laps to go. But once he was in control in that final stint, it never felt like anyone was going to get in range again. Because even with Russell's pace, again, just a couple of mistakes that set him back, when he did have the raw lap time to at least give Max something to think about.
Yeah, like, again, props to McLaren and Mercedes. They're clearly a lot closer than they were this time last year without any question.
This time 3-4 races ago.
Absolutely. Like, the field is closer. Red Bull is there to be punished if they make mistakes, but they're not making mistakes right now. And Max's execution, once again, he kept the coolest head when and he was brilliant when it mattered most. And, yeah, Max joins another little club. He's not only just the third man in history to have 60 career wins, he's also only the third man in history to have 60 wins with one manufacturer. Only Michael Schumacher's, I think it's 72 wins with Ferrari, and Hamilton's 83 wins with Mercedes are higher up on that list. It's 50 wins for Max in his last 75 starts.
Yeah, two-thirds. I mean, it's a two-thirds hit rate in the and since the start of 21. It's just this punishing metronome that, although the Red Bull is not this, I mean, last year they could just BS a setup on the 19 and it wouldn't matter worth a damn because they would drive off into the distance. At least one of them would, and we'll get to the other one later because, oh my God. But when it gets close, that is where the operational, just the bulletproof nature of Red Bull's pit wall, coupled to just how damn consistent Max is, that's what beats you.
Mm-hmm.
And what has happened now is that where Red Bull looked a little bit more vulnerable in the last couple of races, in the Drivers' Championship, Max has actually punched out a nearly 3-race lead now. Because he just ain't dropping points, and certain other entities on the grid are.
This is the big problem if you're someone like Lando Norris. You might have the second best car in the field on paper, but if you're getting into fights with Ferrari and Mercedes now, you're all going to end up taking points off each other, and if Max keeps winning, it's going to hit that much harder over the course of a full season, because Verstappen now has a 56-point lead in the Drivers' Championship again. And it doesn't feel like he's been dominant as much as he has been because of the state of the field closing in. But just like that, it's a 56-point gap again. And we're already
take 2 weekends off and not have a care in the world. And now we get into a slew of tracks where we know the nature of the RB20, the nature of how Red Bull designs their cars. I mean, they're going to break this field over their knee in Barcelona, especially with upgrades projected.
Barca is, we all know, the most staple F1 track we go to, a former test round. It's the most conventional track we go to. Then we've got their home round in Austria, a big power track. We got Silverstone, another big power and aero track coming up after that. These are all strong Red Bull tracks coming up in the very near future. So if Red Bull is going into what should be a stronger run of form for them in the next few weeks, the field's in trouble. The time to punish Red Bull was 2 rounds ago, and they've not really done enough. It's like Thanos all over again. You should have gone for the head, because right now you can't beat Max at the moment. And if you can't beat Max, what are we doing here?
Yeah, and with that fact, like, with the way that this Red Bull is kind of where its strengths and weaknesses have shown, if they still win, if they have a few truly weak tracks, but they're still winning 15, 16 races on the year, you ain't beating that.
No.
You're not beating that unless you are consistently the next car down the road every single weekend and you can pounce. This was another race where they were very vulnerable. You know, not crippled as they were in Monaco, but vulnerable. And Max takes all but the fastest lap point away from the weekend. And he had that for a fair amount of the race. Eventually claimed by, I believe it was Lewis on the fresh hards near the end.
Yeah, Lewis on the final lap, which apparently did get a lot of people talking because That Mercedes is quick. There's no doubt about it. This was, again, their best race weekend for some time, and the pace will certainly catch the attention of a few people. But I did find it interesting that Hamilton didn't say a word to the team after finishing that race in fourth. That's the best Hamilton result he's had since the end of last season, and there was radio silence coming out of that camp.
Dre, this is the first Mercedes podium of 2024.
Yeah, if you don't count the sprint podium they had in China.
I don't acknowledge the existence of the sprint weekend.
Neither did the social media team, to be fair. had to be corrected by a lot of Hamilton fans who think the man's being mistreated on the way out. To which I say, he doesn't want to be there anymore. What do you expect?
Damn, first time for the departing driver treatment. Now, there's been a team in the fight for second. Pretty much every round up to this point. We haven't really said anything about them, Dre.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Pull out the deck chairs, crack a cold one, and praise be to the Haunts.
Oh, welcome back to the Church of Dre. It's been fun. I mean, this was a horror
Unmitigated
show.
Unmitigated disaster?
Yeah, that's how I got it down in my notes. This was an unmitigated disaster. Ferrari had a horror show of a weekend. And they're normally meant to be strong round here, but yet, struggled in qualifying. Both cars got eliminated in Q2. Tried to set their fastest time on used slicks. That did not work out at all for them. Then we get to the race. Charles Leclerc has a power unit issue. It cost him 80 horsepower on his Ferrari. It was losing him a second and a half a lap at certain points before they could get him in for a reset. And, well, they tried to gamble on the slicks by that point. It was far too early for that. And by that point, Ferrari decided,
Remember, that was, they bolted them on right as the rain began to come back down. And
how stupid was that, by the way?
Well, I believe it was Otmar Szafnauer was in the paddock in one of the hospitalities, and he said, you never know with Ferrari, they might bolt on slicks when it's about to rain.
Well,
that's exactly what they did. Forget how the race went. Just the fact that both cars got bounced in Q2, that is a damning result for Ferrari. Just misjudging the gaps on the tires, because this field was very close in qualifying. They should have known better than to try that. But then a triple whammy of reliability issue, strategic screw-up, and then Carlos Sainz having one of the silliest crashes of the weekend.
Spins out on his own at the turn 5 chicane, and as he's backing up from that spin, unfortunately collects Alex Albon on the way out and ends what was a really good drive from Alex Albon that weekend as well. I felt really bad for the tyre driver on that one. If you haven't seen it, by the way, Albon's double pass on Ricciardo and Ocon.
Scotty nominee.
Easy.
Phenomenal pass.
Easy. That was Edo Mortara and Diria in Formula E, only somehow on an even higher degree of difficulty because of the fact he was in the rain. Sensational double overtake from Esteban Ocon, threading the needle like that. On Esteban Ocon there and Ocon and Ricciardo.
Free Alex Albon. And while you're at it, free Charles Leclerc.
No kidding. So with all of that in mind, this weekend was an unmitigated disaster. And this was, I mean, Red Bull had just come off their worst race weekend since probably, God, Bahrain 2022, when both their cars died at the end of the race. Red Bull left Monaco with just 8 points. Ferrari were back in the hunt after Monaco. They were only 24 points off the top in the Constructors' Championship after that one four they had. It was 1-3, I should say. That 1-3 they had at Monaco. And now they left Canada with a double donut, their first double DNF since Baku 2022.
They never even looked, with the engine issue, they never even looked like scoring points in the race. Carlos points made zero table. Progress. Yeah. Carlos made zero progress from his disastrous qualifying, and Leclerc couldn't do anything with a power unit. I mean, he couldn't pass a still shopping cart with no wheels. That car, yeah. It was so slow in a straight line.
just this every. I didn't even mention they had the same break-in issues they had in Bahrain again as well between FP3 and qualifying.
Yeah,
the imbalance on the brakes again as well. This was a horror show. Ferrari didn't operate well in any aspect of this weekend whatsoever. And now Leclerc's lost 25 points to Verstappen, and like he's still second in the Drivers' Championship, but he's now 56 points back.
He's now looking over his shoulder at Lando, because if McLaren's current form continues, it doesn't matter what Ferrari does. Lando's going to pass him.
Yeah. Lando looks like he's now going to be number one contender again going forward, unless Ferrari get back on the eight ball with their form again. It's an uncharacteristically bad weekend from a Ferrari team that generally has performed very well this season so far. The aim, I think, for Ferrari more than anything else this year was to establish yourself as the clear number two team in F1 again. And right now, you don't look like that because McLaren is right there. And if this Mercedes new front wing holds up, Mercedes are back in the fight for second again. After being pretty stagnant for most of this season so far, that was the best Mercedes have looked, you know, in a good year and a half. This is the worst possible time for you to completely shit in the punch bowl this weekend. Yeesh.
Especially when two rounds ago, I mean, the initial discussions in a lot of the media was that this heavily updated Ferrari was going to be fighting up with Red Bull. Well, they were good but not great in Imola, great in Monaco, but they were always expected to be, and then they were legitimately unable to score points in Canada.
Yeah.
That ebb and flow of pace is really concerning.
Yeah. Just not ideal at all from Ferrari. Not much more to say than that, really, for Ferrari, just besides another just clown show weekend. And Ferrari, if they end up not second, it's going to be a very disappointing turnout for this season, because they were tracking like to be the number two team in F1 again for a good while here.
With margin to everyone behind, because they kicked things off. I mean, McLaren did not start the year well. Mercedes started the year horribly.
Mm-hmm.
And this round, McLaren has been superb three rounds in a row. They've been the second best, irrespective of those around them, pretty much all three rounds. And right now, if this Mercedes package is real, we need to see how it does in Barcelona. If the Mercedes is quick in Barcelona, then, you know, they might have something.
Indeed.
They have to shore up their weaknesses yesterday.
Indeed. This is no time to be falling behind the eight ball, most definitely. Right. So, next up, I want to go into some of the silly season stuff, because we've had a bunch of news drop regarding the futures of a few drivers in the field, as mentioned. The big ones, Sergio Perez, now on a 2-year extension at Red Bull Racing. That was announced right before the Canadian Grand Prix weekend started. During the weekend, Yuki Tsunoda was confirmed for 2025 at RB. He'll be the first man ever to do a fourth and now a fifth year in the RB camp in Formula One. And I'll get that one out of the way real quick. Well deserved for Yuki, who's been
right
generally
up until
outstanding.
About four laps to go with this race, because oh my god, Yuki, what were you thinking?
That was ungood.
I tried to follow the race director's instruction. Unfortunately, you drove through the sign rather than around it.
Is that good?
Never good. Especially, again, like, for the RB team, it was a good weekend, but another weekend where they could have scored even more points. Because Ricardo had a great qualifying, had a software glitch, which triggered a false start. His car was creeping on the line.
Yeah.
5-second penalty. Yuki then has a great race up to the point where he drops it, boots it on the wet grass, spins around, and is out of the points. I love that man, but he's making it very difficult sometimes.
He has his moments. I mean, also, this was the first race weekend where Daniel Ricciardo has scored points in the Grand Prix this year.
It's the first race he's showed up for in a few weekends now.
The Ricciardo way. I'll get back to that back in a minute. But yeah, also, because we didn't do an episode on Monaco, we didn't mention the immediate aftermath of Monaco, where Esteban Ocon announced that he and Alpine are parting ways at the end of the year. And it's funny, because Alpine just had their best weekend of the year, 9th and 10th, double points finish for the first time this season. Gasly following Ocon over the line, just holding off the two Hasses behind them.
That was the other way. Gasly finished ahead.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, but I was getting to that point now, because, Ocon was given a team order to move aside for Gasly because they thought there was a small issue with his power unit. Ocon obliged, let Gasly through with the supposed agreement that they were going to swap back at the end of the race. Gasly didn't listen, and Ocon was apparently pissed at the end of the race because he felt like he'd been lied to, because Alpine cannot help themselves with drama.
I find it extraordinary that in the continuing turnover of the Alpine F1 team, this is now going to be the third excellent driver, because let's make no bones about it. Esteban Ocon has been better than Pierre Gasly pretty much every race but Monaco this year.
Mm-hmm.
And they're losing him. They lost Fernando Alonso. And Oscar Piastri is doing a fine job over at McLaren when he decided to get the fuck out of Dodge. Yeah. I do not understand how this team is anything resembling functioning.
I think enough was enough this year. I think the one thing you could say about Alpine, at least through last year, was that they were still a decent midfield team at worst. They were in no man's land in P6 last year compared to the big five in front of them, but at least on a good day with a good chassis, they could occasionally challenge. I mean, they both had a podium finish each last season. They both had their moments in the sun, Gasly and Ocon. But now they're starting to find their way again, as I kind of predicted they would. Once they got the weight off the car and started sorting their shit out, it looks like Alpine are a bit more competitive than what they were at the start of the year, which is a good thing, no question. But what I don't like about it is they're losing drivers at quite an alarming rate, because people don't want to be there. Fernando Alonso would rather have taken a sidestep to go to Aston Martin, because at the time, it was a sidestep when he left there to go there in 2023. And Piastri...
We didn't even mention it. Excellent weekend for them.
Yeah.
Still ahead of Alpine.
Yeah. Yeah, still ahead of him now, even with Aston Martin's, you know, niggles of their own. They're still a far better team than Alpine are at the moment. The same with Piastri, who embarrassed the team at how bad they were and how, you know, you think their contracts would be watertight, and it turns out they just weren't, and they let Piastri go.
Dre, the contract had expired.
Yeah. They didn't even give it a second thought. They just assumed, oh yeah, we could just plug Piastri in and we'll be fine. And turns out they gave him a dead contract to hold on to. And Piastri went and humiliated them like that, and deservedly so. And Piastri's been excellent at McLaren since then. This is a messy team. This is a team that has organizationally been through the ringer. We've mocked them on numerous occasions. I think it would actually be a bigger story how much Alpine is a car crash if it wasn't for bigger and other tumultuous stories that have happened around them as the sport has trundled on for the last couple of years, because right now, they're shit in the breadbasket. They're fighting Williams for P8 right now, which is just, they're a backmarker team.
They're a backmarker, and they're a works team.
Yeah. It's not good enough. It is objectively not good enough right now. And, I mean, speculating about their future, it seems Jack Doohan is the favourite. They'll just plug him in from the academy. Alpine might actually promote a driver from their academy for the first time since Grosjean? In 2011?
Long-haired Romain Grosjean can't hurt you. Long-haired Romain Grosjean. they promoted him and then they dropped him back in 09.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I just don't understand what the end game is for this team, because if it was a case of Alpine not caring, they wouldn't be shifting people in and out of roles constantly. It just feels like they don't know what to do. And like, if you were looking for a works program to latch onto for 2026 when the new regs come around, would anyone pick Alpine? There's no stability. There's no structure to build upon, because you don't know who your designers and drivers and staff are going to be come 26. They could have a completely different set of staff at the top of that team. We just don't know. But that's how bad their turnover has been since returning to F1 as a fact. Really, since the departure of Cyril. It's just been a constant revolving door of drivers, staff, team, designers, everyone.
Well, Bruno Fermin's their fourth team boss in the last 5 years. I forgot until I had to Google it that Marcin Budkowski was once team principal of this team.
Doesn't feel like it, because he was there for such a short amount of time.
He was only there for like a year. And, you know, they've had Cyril.
Marco Mattiacci Ferrari arc.
Yeah. They've had Cyril. They've had Bruno Fermin is now was bumped up from being their engine guy into interim team boss to actual team boss. And then you look at the other list of casualties like Alain Permain, Otmar Szafnauer, Pat Fry's gone. Obviously this year, Dirk De Beer and Matt Harmon, who seemingly really did know what he was doing as technical director of that team. He was the one that was always putting himself forward and talking about the steps that Alpine were going to make. He'd already handed his notice by the time he was talking about the latest car he'd created, which is just wild.
And that car has ended up being the worst one that they've built probably since, what, 16? Which, let's not forget, was also illegal. With that funky brake bias, automatic brake bias system.
And a car that was 10 kilos overweight because their chassis failed tech inspection.
It's just... when we talk about Ferrari not being good enough, it's like, you could say everything there, but Ferrari win races.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Ferrari has an allure. They signed Lewis Hamilton for next year. And Alpine is everything wrong with Ferrari times about 1,000. And nothing they put in place seems to fix it. Nothing brings stability. And until they get stability and they begin to start working towards a common goal, they're just going to keep spinning their wheels in the midfield.
Not ideal. Not ideal at all. And this Alpine team continues to be a hot mess. Looking at the rest of the field, I mean, we mentioned Yuki earlier. I'm going to say something bold. I think Red Bull have just sealed away their Constructors' Championship by re-signing Sergio Perez.
I tend to agree. We have not talked about Sergio because there's been nothing good to say. Yes, he was wiped out in an incident where you can swing the blame either way in Monaco. He was also back with the Haases. He had contact on lap one with one of the Alpines. I believe it was Gasly, actually.
It was Gasly, yeah.
It knocked his front wing. The problem is that he qualified with the Alpines in a Red Bull.
In 18th. Knocked
your ass got out-qualified by Logan Sargeant in a Williams.
It's the sixth time in a year and a half that Logan Sargeant has out-qualified Sergio Perez. Six times.
That doesn't seem possible.
That's unfathomable. Like, this... I find it... Okay. Christian Horner clearly believes that consistency is the best policy at Red Bull. He clearly believes that stability and having the devil you know is better than the devil you don't. To a degree, I can understand that philosophy and that mentality when it came to tying down Sergio Perez. But what about Imola, which was a bad weekend for Perez, and then Monaco, which, okay, wasn't fully on Checo, but the bad qualifying opened him up to more problems than it was necessary.
I mean, Dre, was he ever going to be on points for points at Monaco?
He sucked there for years. He's always been terrible at Monaco. And the thing about
he won in 22, and then he has not gotten into Q3 the last 2 years.
I find it wild that you've seen Perez have those two weekends, and then you handed him a contract for two more years to sign. Apparently, it's a 1+1. Red Bull can cut bait with him at the end of 2025 if they're not happy with him before the next regulation set comes in, if that's how they feel about him. But even so, did the last two weekends not make you stop and reconsider? That because this right now, this feels, for Sergio Perez, this feels like 2023 Taylor's version. Because it's happening again. It's the exact same story we saw last year.
He started off doing exactly what is expected of him, following Max home, following him, you know, even with a not great weekend in Australia. He was still competitive. He still got decent points out of it. And then these last three races, he's looked like the worst driver in Formula One. And it ain't close. Like, Lance Stroll is performing up to par far more than Sergio Perez is. Does anyone here think Lance Stroll should still have his seat in the sport?
I wouldn't, but we all know why he's still there.
Exactly. So you have Perez, like, we're not asking, there is no expectation of him to beat Max. You just need to perform at par. And instead, I mean, he looks like a driver out of his depth. Not a veteran of the midfield who was one of the best pound-for-pound drivers in the sport for a decade.
This was always going to be judgment day for Checo. It was always going to be a case for me of what happens when the field inevitably catches you up. Because F1 is always a sport of diminishing returns. That's been the story with every regulation set. Eventually the field catches up again. Everybody figures out what the ideal design of a car should roughly be for a regulation set by the time we get towards the end of it. We're at that point now where Red Bull can no longer shithouse their way to a Grand Prix win every weekend as long as they execute cleanly. They can and have been punished for bad weekends now. We're at the point where McLaren, Ferrari, and even Mercedes can now punish Checo if he's not anywhere on the podium.
Dre was getting punished by Williams and Haas's.
It's not good enough. It's
beyond not good enough. It's a point of almost, why are you still here? And that should not be the case for Sergio Perez.
It feels like it's
psychological. Like, he's still got it in his head that if he just tries harder, he'll get Max. He ain't gonna, because no one else is.
Someone needs to put an arm around Checo, preferably his extra smiley dad, and tell him, just take the second or the third. Just take the second. You are not beating Max. Max is one of the best F1 drivers we have ever seen. You are not him. It is not your team. It is his team. You are not a title contender. Just get the car home and take the second or third. If he's finishing second or third every week, fine. No one's going to complain about that.
If he's finishing top six, Red Bull still wins the Constructors' Championship relatively comfortably with races in hand. He's not even scoring points now.
You're opening the door for McLaren and Ferrari to stay alive in the Constructors. Because if this season shakes out like the last three or four races, Max ain't winning 19 Grand Prix this year. It might only be 13, 14. And that might just be enough to open the door for McLaren and Ferrari to stay in the range of the Constructors' Championship.
He's the only Red Bull scoring.
Yeah. Max can only score 26 points, 30 or 34 if it's a sprint weekend. There's only so many points he can score on his own every weekend. Mathematically, eventually having two dogs in the fight will overwhelm you, no matter how good you are. You know, I cannot... It is inhuman to expect Max in this current sporting environment to win 18, 19 Grand Prix, because he won't the way the season's going. The rest of the field is too close. He will be punished every once in a while. And that's okay, because Max is still more than good enough to win this championship on his own, drivers-wise. Constructors-wise, he's going to get beaten if this keeps up.
Yeah, and on current form, I mean, again, if there is one, if what does it say about the gap between these two? That on a weekend where, again, Red Bull were competitive, but not dominant.
Mm.
Max goes and ties pole up against Russell, who was just phenomenal in Q3 and got a toe down the back straight from one of the other cars. He tied pole when he wasn't in a position where he could just set a messy lap and it would still be pole. Checo could not get out of Q1 again.
It's not
the
good
gap
enough.
Between the two is getting bigger and bigger.
It's just not good enough, and it's going to cost Red Bull dearly. If Perez already cost his team a constructors championship in 2021, if he keeps this up, he's going to do it again. And you know, maybe Red Bull just don't care about the constructors. I hope they do, because that's the one that pays the bills. That's the one that, you know, shows up on the balance sheet. But I wonder if they've just gone all in on prioritizing Max and just thought, well, fuck the constructors. You know, we're going to finish top two with that no matter what happens. Let's just keep Checo so we have a better chance of keeping Max in the long term, because I just don't get this signing. I don't see what the long-term gain is. Perez is not him. He just hasn't been him. And he's not good enough to be the 10 to 15 podium guy you need him to be right now. He had 6 last year. That's not good enough.
You need him to be 2018, 2019 Bottas. Instead, he's being the worst of 2020 Bottas. Bottas wasn't this bad in 20.
No. He comprehensively beat Checo in 2021. Comprehensively.
I actually, like, it's almost unfathomable to see one car. I mean, let's call it what it is. The Red Bull has still won every race this year but 3.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those had fairly major mitigating. Two of them really had mitigating circumstances. The brake fire and then the floor damage. But the other one unable to score. It's like as big a gulf between like Schumacher in 94 and his teammates who were just getting clubbed by almost 2 seconds every weekend, because everyone knew, one, you're not 1994 Michael Schumacher, and that team is focused exclusively on Michael Schumacher.
Not good enough, and I don't know what Red Bull was trying to do on that one personally. Before we get out of here, I must admit this is kind of my fault. I made this a last minute inclusion, but the FIA did do a big video reveal on Thursday of the race weekend, talking about new regulations, the 2026 regulations, or at least the first look at the 2026 regulations for Formula One have been confirmed. I managed to write down my regulations here. Wow.
That later.
Yeah.
Draft for 26.
Draft for 26. Here's the big bullet points I put together on this to describe what these cars are going to be. It's, sadly, we're not the best visual of medium, so I can only do so much. But here's the quid pro quo. Cars will be 20 centimeters shorter in terms of wheelbase, 10 centimeters narrower, and 15 centimeters reduced on the floor width. So less car on the ground, narrower, shorter cars. A 30 kilo reduction in the minimum weight limit down to 768 kilos. It's currently 798. They're predicting 30% less downforce on these cars, 55% less drag, which is crazy. These cars are going to be flying.
no more Venturi. So they are still, I mean, Formula One cars are still fundamentally ground effect, but they won't have the full length Venturi tunnels like they introduced for the 22 regulations.
Yeah, these things are going to fucking fly in a straight line with 55% less drag and all that hybrid power. Cars are now going to have two settings for front and rear wings for different levels of downforce. They're calling it Z and X mode at the moment. And that will be apparently, according to the FIA, driver operated. So the drivers will have control of what wing settings to run at any given point. It's like playing F1 2010 again, which I think is quite funny.
Good old F-duct. So hold your hand against the cockpit in one hand, El Rouge and Radion.
Yes, as you do. Mums are back in. Manual override mode for the MGUH is gone. We knew that some time ago. But yeah. There'll now be a manual override mode for the MGUK, which means if you go beyond 340 kilometers an hour, you will now have extra hybrid power to deploy. Well, I mean, it's a hell of a threshold to have it at 340 kilometers an hour. These cars are going to fly.
Yeah, because think of it almost like if you played Assetto Corsa, if you've driven the Porsche 919, the funny button where you can dump hybrid power.
Yeah.
That, but a minimum speed threshold of almost of about, what, 213, 214 miles an hour?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, 213, 214. So, yeah, like I said, the bigger, the more
power. These things down the Baku straight, oh my god.
230 mph, I reckon. That's going to be scary. And, of course, the big one, a new, which, again, we already kind of knew about this, a 50-50 split in turbo and hybrid power development, deployment, I should say. So instead of it being, which is currently, I think it's something like 80-20 in terms of internal combustion engine force and hybrid engines, deployment, it's now 50-50.
Yeah, because ICE-wise, we're a little under... probably a little over 900 these days with the development that has been done. And then a cap of 160 on the hybrid power on what you can deploy at a given time. Much more even. Again, much more similar, almost a little bit to like how the LMP1Hs were, although more regulated because that was basically the Wild West in terms of power unit. You do what you want. With this, it's going to be much more mode controlled and driver controlled rather than the automatic systems that define those cars.
So that's most of the big bullet points covered as to what this regulation set is going to be. I mean, what's your impression of these regulation changes, you know, at first glance? Because obviously they're going to get refined. There's no guarantee this is going to be exactly how it ends up. They're going to talk to the teams. There's going to be refinement before it goes to the World Motorsport Council.
Apparently, most of the teams were pissed about most of these regulations, so
they're not happy. Yeah,
we'll see how that develops. I mean, smaller, lighter cars is an immediate win because I mean, we've seen at this point the cars are just too damn big. Where even with these cars having less dirty air than they've had in the past, they're so long and so unable to race around tight sections of track. That it just, there's portions of races that just get very processional. And even, like, if anything, I think the change this year, where you can use DRS after a lap, I think it's actually worsened the DRS train problem.
Oh, I think so, too. I was worried about that.
Yeah, it's worsened the DRS train problem because you just can't move. Because you don't have less drag than the person up in front of you who has DRS. If someone is in a quick car like a Williams up at the front of that train, there's nothing anyone can do about it in a straight line. I like the fact that the cars are smaller. I think the active aero is pretty neat. I need to see how it's implemented. It feels like a lot of these regulations for the car are built around obviously the new power units, the fact that they're going to be coasting on ICE power for an amount, a certain part of that straight. Again, a lot like how the LMP1Hs were in about 2014 to 2017, where you blast the hybrid system to start the straight, and then you kind of coast on ICE. You're going to have the manual override, but there's going to be a limit on how much electricity you can recoup. I need to see how they get refined. I do think the basics on what they've done with the cars in terms of aero and size are better. But we saw that with these regulations, and within 2 years, a combination of size, weight, and just natural development, we're kind of back to where we were.
That's what worries me about all of this, is that in theory, I like these changes. Smaller, nimbler, lighter car is good. You know, I think it'll appease a lot of the older fans. Just hearing the term that DRS is dead is going to please a lot of them, rightly or wrongly.
And the funny thing with that is that basically you're going to have full car DRS now.
Yeah.
Like, you've multiplied the problem that you wanted to kill.
Exactly, because my immediate concern was when I heard that there's going to be a manual override and there's going to be zones where you can change wings. Like, what's the point? Because you're kind of just trading one problem in for another, and arguably potentially made it worse. I want to ask Jake Boxall Lego Autosport about this, because I got a feeling that you're going to just have DRS trains again, just without calling it DRS. You're just going to have trains. And I'm not sure that's ideal for anybody involved. They're going to have to work very hard with the teams to make sure they get the balance right on how much electricity you're allowed to dump and what zones you're allowed to change wings, which all sounds very Wipeout to me at the moment. So we'll have to wait and see how that goes, I suppose. In theory, I like these changes, but I think there's a lot of hurdles that are going to have to be ironed out before we get to this. This is basically an admission that they got 2022 wrong, which I think is the most interesting part of all this to me. Because I don't think they necessarily got it wrong. I think that season when we first got these cars was good. I thought the racing was generally good. You could follow each other closer. And we had some good Grand Prix. I think the problem is that, like you said, once engineers figured out the rule book, what did they do? They added a whole bunch of topside downforce again, and we ended up going back to where we were again a couple of years back with the previous set of regulations. You know, so I get the impression.
But with more weight and less stuff to cut off the cars, because a lot of it's on, you know, it's not the elements on these cars, like the billion little the sticky uppy bits with the 21 cars. It's the shape, and just the basic shapes of the cars now are basically built to outwash from the very contours of the body panels. Your side pods are your barge boards now. There is always going to be an element of the engineers outsmarting the rules and regulations. Every time you cut off downforce, the engineers' jobs are not to make the cars race good. They're there to make them fast. The prototype fan in me just makes that. I just want them to just put covers on the wheels, and you'll solve a lot of those dirty air problems. But that's never going to happen.
There's a lot they're going to have to iron out before we get the final look at this regulation set. But I'm cautiously optimistic, but I think some of the more tighter nuances are going to be worrying. It's not a good sign when the teams are pretty uniformed in their stance of not liking this. I know Andrea Stella was one of the more vocal ones saying these cars are too fast in a straight line and then too slow in the corners, which... Okay, I don't know how that's going to play into racing, but we'll have to wait and see. And
I think that aspect of it will probably help the racing. But at the same time, what have we said before about the convergence? We've now got legitimate convergence at the front of the field with a Red Bull that is not as perfect a machine as it was last year, with a great B-spec McLaren, with a very good B-spec Mercedes. So we're going to blow it all up again in 2 years' time, and someone's going to nail the regulations and skull-fuck this field.
But that's F1. That's always been F1.
It's open formula motorsport. It's just how it works.
They change the rule book every 4 to 5 years to balance the books. It's not... Sometimes you get lucky, and that you get the convergence you're aiming for. The problem is, there's only a year and a half left of this regulation set now. Sorry, you know, that's just how it goes sometimes. We'll have to wait and see.
And on the power unit side, we just don't know, because, I mean, the last major power unit shift we had, well, none of the cars worked. None of them. Even the one that turned the field to paste for 2014, 15, 16, some of 17, some of 18, all of 19, all of 20, half of 21.
I sense a pattern here somehow. But yeah, we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. Yeah, next Formula One race, as mentioned, Spanish Grand Prix at Catalunya next weekend. If Red Bull are still as dominant as they might be next weekend, cancel Christmas because it's over. I promise you that. We'll have to wait and see.
Expecting a return to form, let's say.
I think so too. I think I think that will be the real test of this field and where they're at that point in time. If Red Bull goes to Catalunya like last year when Max had half a second on the field, it is donezo out here in this town. I think we'll really see where the field is at, relatively speaking. Good tire wear test, big test of power, big test of aerodynamics.
Best track in the world.
Yep. Let's see how Catalunya's penultimate race on the F1 calendar turns out next week. As mentioned, full Le Mans preview coming up very, very shortly as well. Stick around for that before the greatest race of the world, the 24 Hours of Le Mans, this Saturday. But until next time, I've been Dre Harrison. He's been Cam Buckley. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
Even when you think we can beat this guy, we just can't beat this guy.